and her voice seemed magnified, like the voice of a giant. Locked in a room in the highest level of the tallest stalagmite mound within the Oblodrin compound, Kiorolodron heard Beanri's call, heard it clearly. Her hands gripped tight on her throne's carved marble arms. She squeezed her eyes shut as she ordered herself to concentrate. Now, above any other time, Kiorol needed her powers, and now, for the first time, she could not access them. Something was terribly wrong, she knew, and though she believed that Lolf must somehow be behind this, she sensed, as many of the Spider Queen's priestesses had sensed when the time of troubles had begun, that this trouble was beyond even Lolf. The problems had begun soon after Kiorol had been chased back to her house by the loosed Tanari. She and her daughters had gathered to formulate an attack plan to drive off the fiends. As always with the efficient Oblodrin meetings, the group shared its thoughts telepathically, the equivalent of holding several understandable conversations at once. The defense plan was coming together well. Kiorol grew confident that the Tanari would be sent back to their own plane of existence, and when that was accomplished, she and her family could go and properly punish Matron Beanri and the others. Then something terrible had happened. One of the Tanari had thrown forth a blast of lightning, a searing, blinding bolt that sent a crack running along the outer wall of the Oblodrin compound. That in itself was not so bad. The compound, like all the houses of Menzo Berenzon, could take a tremendous amount of punishment. But what the blast, what the return of magical powers signified, was disastrous to the Oblodrins. At that same moment, the telepathic conversation had abruptly ended, and try as they may, the nobles of the doomed house could not begin it anew. Kiorol was intelligent as any drow in Menzo Berenzon. Her powers of concentration were unparalleled. She felt the psionic strength within her mind, the powers that allowed her to walk through walls or yank the beating heart from an enemy's chest. They were there, deep in her mind, but she could not bring them forth. She continued to blame herself, her lack of concentration in the face of disaster. She even punched herself on the side of the head, as if that physical jarring would knock out some magical manifestation. Her efforts were futile. As the time of troubles had come to its end, as the tapestry of magic in the realms had rewoven, many rippling side effects had occurred. Throughout the realms, dead magic zones had appeared, areas where no spells would function, or even worse, where no spells would function as intended. Another of those side effects involved psionic powers, the magic-like powers of the mind. The strength was still there, as Kiorol sensed, but bringing forth that strength required a different mental route than before. The Illithids, as Mephil had informed Matron Beanri, had already discerned that route, and their powers were functioning nearly as completely as before. But they were an entire race of psionicists, and a race possessed of communal intelligence. The Illithids had already made the necessary adjustments to accessing their psionic powers, but Kiorol Odron and her once powerful family had not. So the matron of the third house sat in the darkness, eyes squeezed tightly shut, concentrating. She heard Beanri's call, knew that if she did not go to Beanri, Beanri would soon come to her. Given time, Kiorol would have sorted through the mental puzzle. Given a month, perhaps, she would have begun to bring forth her powers once more. Kiorol didn't have a month. Kiorol didn't have an hour. Matron Beanri felt the pulsing magic within the lump of sulfur, an inner heat fast building in intensity. She was amazed as her hand shifted, as the sulfur implored her to change the angle. Beanri nodded. She understood then that some force from beyond the material plane, some creature of the abyss, and perhaps even Lolf herself, was guiding the movement. Up went her hand, putting the pulsing lump in line with the top level of the highest tower in the Oblodrin compound.
"Who are you?" she asked.
"I am Ertu,"
came a reply in her mind. Beanri knew the name, knew the creature was a Baelor, the most terrible and powerful of all Tanari. Lolf had armed her well. She felt the pure malice of the connected creature building within the sulfur, felt the energy growing to where she thought the lump would explode, probably bringing Ertu to her side. That could not happen, of course, though she did not know it. It was the power of the artifact itself she felt, that seemingly innocuous piece of sulfur, imbued with the magic of Loth, wielded by the highest priestess of the Spider Queen in all of Menzo Baranzon. Purely on instinct, Beanri flattened her hand, and the sulfur sent forth a line of glowing, crackling yellow light. It struck the wall high on the Oblodron Tower, the very wall between Kioral and Beanri. Lines of light and energy encircled the stalagmite mound, crackling, biting into the stone, stealing the integrity of the place. The sulfur went quiet again, its bolt of seemingly live energy freed. But Beanri did not lower her hand, and did not take her awestruck stare from the tower wall. Neither did the 10,000 dark elves that stood behind her. Neither did Kioral Odron, who could suddenly see the yellow lines of destruction as they ate their way through the stone. All in the city gasped, as one of the tower's top exploded into dust and was blown away. There sat Kioral, still atop her black marble throne, suddenly in the open, staring down at the tremendous gathering. Many winged Denari swooped around the vulnerable matron mother, but they did not approach too closely, wisely fearing the wrath of Ertu should they steal even a moment of his fun. Kioral, always proud and strong, rose from her throne and walked to the edge of the tower. She surveyed the gathering, and so respectful were many drow, even matron mothers of her strange powers, that they turned away when they felt her scrutinizing gaze on them, as though she, from on high, was deciding who she would punish for this attack. Finally, Kioral's gaze settled on Matron Beanri, who did not flinch and did not turn away.
"You dare!" Kioral roared down, but her voice seemed small. "You dare!" Matron Beanri yelled back, the power of her voice echoing off the walls of the cavern. "You have forsaken the Spider Queen!" "To the abyss with Lolth, where she rightly belongs!" stubborn Kioral replied, the last words she ever spoke. Beanri thrust her hand higher and felt the next manifestation of power, the opening of an interplanar gate. No yellow light came forth, no visible force at all, but Kioral felt it keenly. She tried to call out in protest, but could say nothing beyond a whimper and a gurgle, as her features suddenly twisted, elongated. She tried to resist, dug her heels in, and concentrated once more on bringing forth her powers. Kioral felt her skin being pulled free of her bones, felt her entire form being stretched out of shape, elongated, as the sulfur pulled at her with undeniable strength. Stubbornly she held on through the incredible agony, through the horrible realization of her doom. She opened her mouth, wanting to utter one more damning curse, but all that came out was her tongue, pulled to its length and beyond. Kioral felt her entire body stretching down from the tower, reaching for the sulfur and the gate. She should have been dead already. Matron Beanri held her hand steady, but could not help closing her eyes, as Kioral's weirdly elongated form suddenly flew from the top of the broken tower, soaring straight for her. Several drow, Bergignon included, screamed, others gasped again, and still others called to the glory of Lolth, as Kioral, stretched and narrowed so that she resembled a living spear, entered the sulfur, the gate that would take her to the abyss, to Ertu, Lolth's appointed agent of torture. Behind Kioral came the fiends with a tremendous fanfare, roaring and loosing bolts of lightning against the Oblodron compound, igniting balls of exploding fire and other blinding displays of their power. Compelled by Ertu, they stretched and thinned and flew into the sulfur, and Matron Beanri held on against her terror, transforming it into a sensation of sheer power. In a few moments, all the fiends, even the greatest Tenari, were gone. Matron Beanri felt their presence still, transformed somehow within the sulfur. Suddenly it was quiet once more. Many dark elves looked to each other, wondering if the punishment was complete, wondering if House Oblodra would be allowed to survive under a new leader. Nobles from several different houses flashed signals to each other, expressing their concern that Beanri would now put one of her own daughters in command of the third house, further sealing her ultimate position within the city. But Beanri had no such thoughts. This was a punishment demanded by Lolth, a complete punishment, as terrible as anything that had ever been exacted on a house in Menzo Berenzon. Again heeding the telepathic instructions of Ertu, Matron Beanri hurled the throbbing piece of sulfur into the claw rift, and when cheers went up around her, the dark elves thinking the ceremony complete, she raised her arms out wide and commanded them all to witness the wrath of Lolth. They felt the first rumblings within the claw rift beneath their feet. A few anxious moments passed, too quiet, too hushed. One of Kioral's daughters appeared on the open platform atop the broken tower. She ran to the edge, calling, pleading to Matron Beanri. A moment later, when Beanri gave no response, she happened to glance to the side, to one of the finger-like chasms of the great claw rift. Wide went her eyes, and her scream was as terrified as any drow had ever heard. From the higher vantage point offered by her levitation spell, Matron Beanri followed the gaze and was next to react, throwing her arms high and wide and crying out to her goddess in ecstasy. A moment later, the gathering understood. A huge black tentacle snaked over the rim of the claw rift, wriggling its way behind the Oblodrin compound. Like a wave, dark elves fell back, stumbling all over each other, as the 20-foot-thick monstrosity came around the back, along the side, and along the front wall, back toward the chasm. "Beanri!" pleaded the desperate, doomed Oblodrin.
"You have denied Lolth," the first matron mother replied calmly. "Feel her wrath!"
The ground beneath the cavern trembled slightly as the tentacle, the angry hand of Lolth, tightened its grasp on the Oblodrin compound. The wall buckled and collapsed as the thing began its steady sweep. Kioral's daughter leaped from the tower as it too began to crumble. She cleared the tentacle and was still alive, though broken on the ground when a group of dark elves got to her. Yutha Gentol Armgo was among that group, and the mighty weapons master pushed aside the others, preventing them from finishing the pitiful creature off. He hoisted the Odrin in his powerful arms, and through bleary eyes the battered female regarded him, even managed a faint smile, as though she expected he had come out to save her. Yutha Gentol laughed at her, lifted her above his head and ran forward, heaving her over the side of the tentacle, back into the rolling rubble that had been her house. The cheers, the screams were deafening, and so was the rumble as the tentacle swept all that had been House Oblodra, all the structures and all the drow, into the chasm. Chapter 15 Greed. The mercenary shook his bald head, as defiant an act as he had ever made against Matron Beanri. At this moment, so soon after the first matron mother's awesome display of power, and given the fact that she was obviously in the Spider Queen's highest favor, Jarlaxle's questioning of her plans seemed even more dangerous. Triel Beanri sneered at Jarlaxle, and Bergignon closed his eyes. Neither of them really wanted to see the useful male beaten to death. Wicked Bladen Curse, though, licked her lips anxiously, and gripped the five-headed tentacle whip tied on her hip, hoping that her mother would allow her the pleasure. "I fear it is not the time," Jarlaxle said openly, bluntly.
"Lolth instructs me differently," Beanri replied, and she seemed quite cool and calm, given the defiance of a mere male. "We cannot be certain that our magic will continue to work as we expect," Jarlaxle reasoned.
Beanri nodded, and the others then realized, to their absolute surprise, that their mother was glad the mercenary was taking a negative role. Jarlaxle's questions were pertinent, and he was, in fact, helping Beanri sort through the details of her proposed new alliance and the march to Mithril Hall. Triel Beanri eyed her mother suspiciously as all of this sank in. If Matron Bayenri had received her instructions directly from the Spider Queen, as she had openly stated, then why would she want or even tolerate defiance or questioning at all? Why would Matron Bayenri need to have these most basic questions concerning the wisdom of the march answered?
The magic is secure, Bayenri replied.
Jarlaxle conceded the point. Everything he had heard, both within and beyond the Drow city, seemed to back that claim. You will have no trouble forming an alliance after the spectacle of House O'Blodra's fall. Matron Mez Barris Armgo has been supportive all along, and no matron mother would dare even hint that she fears to follow your lead.
The Claw Rift is large enough to hold the rubble of many houses, Bayenri said dryly.
Jarlaxle snickered. Indeed, he said. And indeed, this is the time for alliance, for whatever purpose that alliance must be formed.
It is time to march to Mithril Hall, Bayenri interrupted, her tone one of finality. Time to rise up from despair and bring higher glories to the Spider Queen.
We have suffered many losses, Jarlaxle dared to press. House O'Blodra and their kobold slaves were to lead the attack, dying in the dwarven trap set for Drow.
The kobolds will be brought up from their holes in the Claw Rift, Bayenri assured him.
Jarlaxle didn't disagree. But he knew the tunnels below the rim of the chasm better than anyone, now that all of House O'Blodra was dead. Bayenri would get some kobolds, several hundred perhaps, but House O'Blodra could have provided many thousand. The city's hierarchy is in question, the mercenary went on. The third house is no more, and the fourth is without its matron mother. Your own family still has not recovered from the renegade's escape and the loss of Dantrag and Vendez. Bayenri suddenly sat forward in her throne. Jarlaxle didn't flinch, but many of the Bayenri children did, fearing that their mother understood the truth of the mercenary's last statement, and that Bayenri simply would not tolerate any bickering between her surviving children as they sorted out the responsibilities and opportunities left open by the loss of their brother and sister. Bayenri stopped as quickly as she had started, standing before the throne. She let her dangerous gaze linger over each of her gathered children, then dropped it fully over the impertinent mercenary.
"Come with me," she commanded.
Jarlaxle stepped aside to let her pass, and obediently and wisely fell into step right behind her. Triel moved to follow, but Bayenri spun around, stopping her daughter in her tracks.
"Just him," she growled.
A black column centered the throne room, and a crack appeared along its seemingly perfect and unblemished side as Bayenri and the mercenary approached. The crack widened as the cunning door slid open, allowing the two to enter the cylindrical chamber within. Jarlaxle expected Bayenri to yell at him, or to talk to him, even threaten him once the door closed again, separating them from her family. But the matron mother said nothing, just calmly walked over to a hole in the floor. She stepped into the hole, but did not fall, rather floated down to the next lower level, the great Bayenri mound's third level, on currents of magical energy. Jarlaxle followed as soon as the way was clear, but still, when he got to the third level, he had to hurry to keep up with the hustling matron mother, gliding through the floor once more and again, until she came to the dungeons beneath the great mound. Still she offered not a word of explanation, and Jarlaxle began to wonder if he was to be imprisoned down here. Many drow, even drow nobles, had found that grim fate. It was rumored that several had been kept as Bayenri prisoners for more than a century, endlessly tortured, then healed by the priestesses that they might be tortured again. A wave of Bayenri's hand sent the two guards standing beside one cell door scrambling for cover. Jarlaxle was as relieved as curious when he walked into the cell behind Bayenri to find a curious, barrel-chested dwarf chained to the far wall. The mercenary looked back to Bayenri, and only then did he realize she was not wearing one of her customary necklaces, the one fashioned of a dwarf's tooth.
"A recent catch?" Jarlaxle asked, though he suspected differently. 2,000 years, Beanri replied. I give to you Gandalag Battlehammer, patron of Clan Battlehammer, founder of Mithril Hall.
Jarlaxle rocked back on his heels. He had heard the rumors, of course, that Beanri's tooth pendant contained the soul of an ancient dwarf king, but never had he suspected such a connection. He realized then, suddenly, that this entire foray to Mithril Hall was not about Drizzt O'Urden, that the renegade was merely a connection, an excuse for something Beanri had desired for a very long time. Jarlaxle looked at Beanri suddenly, curiously.
2,000 years? He echoed aloud, while he silently wondered just how old this withered drow really was.
I have kept his soul through the centuries, Beanri went on, eyeing the old dwarf directly. During the time Lolth could not hear our call, the item was destroyed, and Gandalag came forth alive again.
She walked over, put her snarling visage right up to the battered, naked dwarf's long, pointed nose, and put one hand on his round, solid shoulder.
Alive, but no more free than he was before.
Gandalag cleared his throat, as if he meant to spit on Beanri. He stopped, though, when he realized that a spider had crawled out of the ring on her hand, onto his shoulder, and was now making its way along his neck. Gandalag understood that Beanri would not kill him, that she needed him for her proposed conquest. He did not fear death, but would have preferred it to this torment, and weighed against the realization that he might unwittingly aid in the fall of his own people. Beanri's gruesome mind flayer had already scoured Gandalag's thoughts more than once, taking information that no beatings could ever have extracted from the stubborn old dwarf. Rationally, Gandalag had nothing to fear, but that did little to comfort him now. Gandalag hated spiders above all else, hated and feared them. As soon as he felt the hairy, crawly thing on his neck, he froze, eyes unblinking, sweat beading on his forehead. Beanri walked away, leaving her pet spider on the dwarf's neck. She turned to Jarlaxle again, a supreme look on her face, as though Gandalag's presence should make all the difference in the world to the doubting mercenary. It didn't. Jarlaxle never once doubted that Menzo Baranzon could defeat Mithril Hall, never once doubted that the conquest would be successful. But what of the aftermath of that conquest? The drow city was in turmoil. There would soon be a fierce struggle, perhaps even an open war, to fill the vacancy left by both House O'Blodra's demise and the death of Jenny Tiroth Tlabar. Living for centuries on the edge of disaster with his secretive band, the mercenary understood the perils of overextending his grab for power, understood that if one stretched his forces too far, they could simply collapse. But Jarlaxle knew, too, that he would not convince Matron Beanri. So be it, he decided. Let Beanri march to Mithril Hall with no further questions from him. He would even encourage her. If things went as she planned, then all would be the better for it. If not? Jarlaxle didn't bother to entertain those possibilities. He knew where Gromph stood, knew the wizard's frustration and the frustrations of Bregan de Earth, a band almost exclusively male. Let Beanri go to Mithril Hall, and if she failed, then Jarlaxle would take Beanri's own advice and rise up from despair. Indeed.
Chapter 16 Open Hearts. Drizzt found her on the same east-facing plateau where she had practiced all those 10 days, the very spot where she had at last gained control of her strong-willed sword. Long shadows rolled out from the mountains, the sun low in the sky behind them. The first stars shone clearly, twinkling above Silvery Moon, and Sundabar to the east beyond that. Catti Bree sat unmoving,
legs bent and knees pulled in tightly to her chest. If she heard the approach of the almost silent drow, she gave no indication, just rocked gently back and forth, staring into the deepening gloom. "The night is beautiful," Drizzt said. And when Catibree did not jump at the sound of his voice, he realized she had recognized his approach. "But the wind is chill."
"The winter's coming in full," Catibree replied softly, not taking her gaze from the darkened eastern sky.
Drizzt sought a reply, wanted to keep talking. He felt awkward here, strangely so, for never in the years he had known Catibree had there been such tension between them. The drow walked over and crouched beside Catibree, but did not look at her, as she did not look at him.
"I'll call Guinevere this night,"
Drizzt remarked. Catibree nodded. Her continued silence caught the drow off guard. His calling of the panther, for the first time since the figurine was repaired, was no small thing. Would the figurine's magic work properly, enabling Guinevere to return to his side? Fret had assured him it would, but Drizzt could not be certain, could not rest easily until the task was completed and the panther, the healed panther, was back beside him. It should have been important to Catibree as well. She should have cared as much as Drizzt cared, for she and Guinevere were as close as any. Yet she didn't reply. And her silence made Drizzt, anger budding within him, turn to regard her more closely. He saw tears rimming her blue eyes. Tears that washed away Drizzt's anger. That told him that what had happened between himself and Catibree had apparently not been so deeply buried. The last time they had met, on this very spot, they had hidden the questions they both wanted to ask behind the energy of a sparring match. Catibree's concentration had to be complete on that occasion, and in the days before it, as she fought to master her sword. But now that task was completed. Now, like Drizzt, she had time to think, and in that time, Catibree had remembered.
"You're knowing it was the sword,"
she asked, almost pleaded. Drizzt smiled, trying to comfort her. Of course it had been the sentient sword that had inspired her to throw herself at him. Fully the sword, only the sword. But a large part of Drizzt, and possibly of Catibree, he thought in looking at her, wished differently. There had been an undeniable tension between them for some time, a complicated situation, and even more so now, after the possession incident with Kazithea.
"You did right in pushing me away,"
Catibree said. And she snorted and cleared her throat, hiding a sniffle. Drizzt paused for a long moment, realizing the potential weight of his reply. "I pushed you away only because I saw the pommel," he said. And that drew Catibree's attention from the eastern sky, made her look at the drow directly, her deep blue eyes locking with his violet orbs. "It was the sword," Drizzt said quietly. "Only the sword." Catibree didn't blink, barely drew breath. She was thinking how noble this drow had been. So many other men would not have asked questions, would have taken advantage of the situation. And would that have been such a bad thing, the young woman had to ask herself now. Her feelings for Drizzt were deep and real, a bond of friendship and love. Would it have been such a bad thing if he had made love to her in that room? Yes, she decided, for both of them, because while it was her body that had been offered, it was Kazithea that was in control. Things were awkward enough between them now, but if Drizzt had relented to the feelings that Catibree knew he held for her, if he had not been so noble in that strange situation and had given in to the offered temptation, likely neither of them would have been able to look the other in the eye afterward, like they were doing now. on a quiet plateau high in the mountains, with a chill and crisp breeze, and the stars glowing ever more brightly above them.
You're a good man, Dries Doerden,
the grateful woman said with a heartfelt smile. Hardly a man, Drizzt replied, chuckling, and glad for the relief of tension. Only a temporary relief, though. The chuckle and the smile died away almost immediately, leaving them in the same place, the same awkward moment, caught somewhere between romance and fear. Catty Bree looked back to the sky, and Drizzt did likewise.
Ye know I loved him,
the young woman said. You still do, Drizzt answered, and his smile was genuine when Catty Bree turned back again to regard him. She turned away almost at once, looked back to the bright stars and thought of Wulfgar. You would have married him, Drizzt went on. Catty Bree wasn't so sure of that. For all the true love she held for Wulfgar, the barbarian carried around the weight of his heritage and a society that valued women not as partners, but as servants. Wulfgar had climbed above many of the narrow-thinking ways of his tribal people, but as his wedding to Catty Bree approached, he had become more protective of her, to the point of being insulting. That, above everything else, proud and capable Catty Bree could not tolerate. Her doubts were clear on her face, and Drizzt, who knew her better than anyone, read them easily. You would have married him, he said again, his firm tone forcing Catty Bree to look back to him. Wulfgar was no fool, Drizzt went on.
Don't ye be blaming it all on Entreri and the halfling's gem, Catty Bree warned.
After the threat of the drow hunting party had been turned away, after Wulfgar's demise, Drizzt had explained to her and to Brunner, who perhaps more than anyone else needed to hear the justification, that Entreri, posing as Regis, had used the hypnotic powers of a ruby pendant on Wulfgar. Yet that theory could not fully explain the barbarian's outrageous behavior, because Wulfgar had started down that path long before Entreri had even arrived at Mithril Hall. Surely the gem pushed Wulfgar further, Drizzt countered.
Pushed him where he wanted to go?
No. The simple reply, spoken with absolute surety, almost caught Catty Bree off guard. She cocked her head to the side, her thick auburn hair cascading over one shoulder, waiting for the drow to elaborate. He was scared, Drizzt went on. Nothing in the world frightened mighty Wulfgar more than the thought of losing his Catty Bree.
His Catty Bree, she echoed.
Drizzt laughed at her oversensitivity. His Catty Bree, as he was your Wulfgar, he said. And Catty Bree's smirk fell away as fully as her trap of words. He loved you, Drizzt went on, with all his heart. He paused, but Catty Bree had nothing to say, just sat very still, very quiet, hearing his every word. He loved you, and that love made him feel vulnerable and frightened him. Nothing anyone could do to Wulfgar, not torture, not battle, not even death frightened him. But the slightest scratch on Catty Bree would burn like a hot dagger in his heart. So he acted the part of the fool for a short while before you were to be wed, Drizzt said. The very next time you saw battle, your own strength and independence would have held a mirror up to Wulfgar, would have shown him his error. And like so many of his proud people. Unlike Berkthgar, Wulfgar admitted his mistakes and never made them again. As she listened to the words of her wise friend, Catty Bree remembered exactly that incident. The battle in which Wulfgar had been killed. Those very fears for Catty Bree had played a large part in the barbarian's death. But before he was taken from her, he had looked into her eyes, and had indeed realized what his foolishness had cost him, had cost them both. Caterbury had to believe that now, recalling the scene in light of the drow's words. She had to believe that her love for Wulfgar had been real, very real, and not misplaced, that he was all she had thought him to be. Now she could. For the first time since Wulfgar's death, Caterbury could remember him without the pangs of guilt, without the fears that, had he lived, she would not have married him. Because Drizzt was right. Wulfgar would have admitted the error, despite his pride, and he would have grown, as he always had before. That was the finest quality of the man, an almost childlike quality, that viewed the world and his own life as getting better, as moving toward a better way, in a better place. What followed was the most sincere smile on Caterbury's face in many, many months. She felt suddenly free, suddenly complete with her past, reconciled and able to move forward with her life. She looked at the drow, wide-eyed, with a curiosity that seemed to surprise Drizzt. She could go on. But exactly what did that mean? Slowly, Caterbury began shaking her head, and Drizzt came to understand that the movement had something to do with him. He lifted a slender hand and brushed some stray hair back from her cheek, his ebony skin contrasting starkly with her light skin, even in the quiet light of night. "I do love you," the drow admitted. The blunt statement did not catch Caterbury by surprise, not at all. "As you love me," Drizzt went on easily, confident that his words were on the mark. "And I too must look ahead now, must find my place among my friends, beside you without Wulfgar."
"Perhaps in the future,"
Caterbury said, her voice barely a whisper. "Perhaps," Drizzt agreed. "But for now,
friends,"
Caterbury finished. Drizzt moved his hand back from her cheek, held it in the air before her face, and she reached up and clasped it firmly.
"Friends."
The moment lingered, the two staring, not talking, and it would have gone on much, much longer, except that there came a commotion from the trail behind them and the sound of voices they both recognized.
"Stupid elf couldn't do this inside," blustered Brunner.
"The stars are more fitting for Guinevere,"
huffed Regis breathlessly. Together they crashed through a bush not far behind the plateau and stumbled and skidded down to join their two friends.
"Stupid elf,"
Caterbury asked her father.
"Bah!" Brunner snorted. "I'm not for saying—"
"Well, actually—"
Regis began to correct, but changed his mind when Brunner turned his scarred visage the halfling's way and growled at him.
"So you're right, and I said stupid elf,"
Brunner admitted, speaking mostly to Drizzt, as close to an apology as he ever gave.
"But I've got me work to do."
He looked back up the trail in the direction of Mithril Hall's eastern door.
"Inside,"
he finished. Drizzt took out the onyx figurine and placed it on the ground, purposely right before the dwarf's heavy boots.
"When Guinevere is returned to us, I will explain how inconvenienced you were to come and witness her return," Drizzt said with a smirk.
"Stupid elf,"
Brunner muttered under his breath, and he fully expected that Drizzt would have the cat sleep on him again, or something worse. Caterbury and Regis laughed, but their mirth was strained and nervous, as Drizzt called quietly for the panther. The pain they would have to bear if the magic of the figurine had not healed, if Guinevere did not return to them, would be no less to the companions than the pain of losing Wulfgar. They all knew it, even surly, blustery Brunner, who to his grave would deny his affection for the magical panther. Silence grew around the figurine, as the gray smoke came forth, swirled and solidified. Guinevere seemed almost confused as she regarded the four companions standing around her, none of them daring to breathe. Drizzt's grin was the first and the widest, as he saw that his trusted companion was whole again and healed, the black fur glistening in the starlight, the sleek muscles taut and strong. He had brought Brunner and Regis out to witness this moment. It was fitting that all four of them stood by when Guinevere returned. More fitting would it have been, had the sixth companion, Wulfgar, son of Beornigar, joined them on that plateau. In the quiet night, under the stars, in the last hours of Mithril Hall's peace. Part 4. The Drow March. I noticed something truly amazing and truly heartwarming as we, all the defenders of Mithril Hall and the immediate region, neared the end of preparations. Neared the time when the Drow would come. I am Drow. My skin proves that I am different. The ebony hue shows my heritage clearly and undeniably. And yet, not a glare was aimed my way. Not a look of consternation from the Harples and the Long Riders. Not an angry word from volatile Berkthgar and his warrior people. And no dwarf, not even General Dagna, who did not like anyone who was not a dwarf, pointed an accusing finger at me. We did not know why the Drow had come. Be it for me or for the promise of treasure from the rich dwarven complex. Whatever the cause, to the defenders, I was without blame. How wonderful that felt to me. Who had worn the burden of self-imposed guilt for many months. Guilt for the previous raid. Guilt for Wulfgar. Guilt that Catti Bree had been forced by friendship to chase me all the way to Menzo Baranzon. I had worn this heavy collar. And yet those around me, who had as much to lose as I, placed no burden on me. You cannot understand how special that realization was to one of my past. It was a gesture of sincere friendship. And what made it all the more important is that it was an unintentional gesture, offered without thought or purpose. Too often in the past, my friends would make such gestures, as if to prove something, more to themselves than to me. They could feel better about themselves, because they could look beyond the obvious differences, such as the color of my skin. Guinevere never did that. Brunner never did that. Neither did Catti Bree or Regis. Wulfgar at first despised me, openly and without excuse, simply because I was Drow. They were honest, and thus they were always my friends. But in the days of preparation for war, I saw that sphere of friendship expand many times over. I came to know that the dwarves of Mithril Hall, the men and women of Settlestone, and many, many more, truly accepted me. That is the honest nature of friendship. That is when it becomes sincere and not self-serving. So in those days, Drizzt O'Erden came to understand, once and for all, that he was not of Menzo Baranzon. I threw off the collar of guilt. I smiled. Drizzt Do'Urden. Chapter 17. Blingdenstone. They were shadows among the shadows, flickering movements that disappeared before the eye could take them in. And there was no sound, though 300 dark elves moved in formation, right flank, left flank, center. There was no sound. They had come to the west of Menzo Baranzon, seeking the easier and wider tunnels that would swing them back toward the east and all the way to the surface, to Mithril Hall. Blingdenstone, the city of Zverfnebli, whom the Drow hated above all others, was not so far away, another benefit of this roundabout course. Yutha Gentall Armgo paused in one small sheltered cubby. The tunnels were wide, uncomfortably so. Zverfnebli were tacticians and builders, and in a fight they would depend on formations, perhaps even on war machines, to compete with a more stealthy and individual-minded drow. The widening of these particular tunnels was no accident, Euthygentol knew, and no result of nature. This battlefield had long ago been prepared by his enemies. So where were they? Euthygentol had come into their domain with 300 drow, his group leading an army of 8,000 dark elves and thousands of humanoid slaves. And yet, though Blingdenstone itself could not be more than a 20-minute march from his position, and his scouts were even closer than that, there had been no sign of Zverfnebli. The wild patron of Barrison Dalarmgo was not happy. Euthygentol liked things predictable, at least as far as enemies were concerned, and had hoped that he and his warriors would have seen some action against the gnomes by now. It was no accident that his group, that he was at the forefront of the drow army. That had been a concession by Beanri to Mez Barris, an affirmation of the importance of the Second House. But with that concession came responsibility, which Matron Mez Barris had promptly dropped on Euthygentol's sturdy shoulders. House Barris and Dalarmgo needed to come out of this war with high glory, particularly in light of Matron Beanri's incredible display in the destruction of House Oblodra. When this business with Mithril Hall was settled, the rearrangement of the pecking order in Menzo Berenzon would likely begin. Inter-house wars seemed unavoidable, with the biggest holes to be filled those ranks directly behind Barris and Dalarmgo. Thus had Matron Mez Barris promised full fealty to Beanri in exchange for being personally excused from the expedition. She remained in Menzo Berenzon, solidifying her house's position and working closely with Triel Beanri in forming a web of lies and allies to insulate House Beanri from further accusations. Beanri had agreed with Mez Barris's offer, knowing that she too would be vulnerable if all did not go well in Mithril Hall. With the matron mother of his house back in Menzo Berenzon, the glory of House Barris and Dalarmgo was Euthygentol's to find. The fierce warrior was glad for the task, but he was edgy as well, filled with nervous energy, wanting a battle, any battle, that he might whet his appetite for what was to come, and might wet the end of his wicked trident with the blood of an enemy. But where were the ugly little Zverfnebli, he wondered. The marching plan called for no attack on Blingdenstone proper, not on the initial journey at least. If there was to be an assault on the Gnome City, it would come on the return from Mithril Hall, after the main objective had been realized. Euthygentol had been given permission to test Zverfneblin defenses, though, and to skirmish with any gnomes he and his warriors found out in the open tunnels. Euthygentol craved that, and had already determined that if he found and tested the gnome defenses and discovered sufficient holes in them, he would take the extra step, hoping to return to Beanri's side with the head of the Zverfneblin king on the end of his trident. All glory for Barrison Dalarmgo. One of the scouts slipped back past the guards, moved right up to the fierce warrior. Her fingers flashed in a silent drow code, explaining to her leader that she had gone closer, much closer, had even seen the stairway that led up to the level of Blingdenstone's massive front gates. But no sign had she seen of the Zverfnebli. It had to be an ambush. Every instinct within the seasoned weapons master told Euthygentol that the Zverfnebli were lying in wait, in full force. Almost any other dark elf, a race known for caution when dealing with others, mostly because the drow knew they could always win such encounters if they struck at the appropriate time, would have relented. In truth, Euthygentol's mission, a scouting expedition, was now complete, and he could return to Matron Beanri with a full report that she would be pleased to hear. But fierce Euthygentol was not like other drow. He was less than relieved, was in fact boiling with rage.
"Take me there," his fingers flashed, to the surprise of a female scout.
"You are too valuable,"
the female's hands replied.
"All of us!"
Euthygentol roared aloud, his volume surprising every one of the many dark elves around him. But Euthygentol wasn't startled and did not relent.
"Send the word along every column," he went on, "to follow my lead to the very gates of Blingdenstone."
More than a few drow soldiers turned nervous looks to each other. They numbered 300, a formidable force, but Blingdenstone held many times that number, and Svirfnebli, full of tricks with the stone and often allied with powerful monsters from the plane of Earth, were not easy foes. Still, not one of the Dark Elves would argue with Euthygentol Armgo, especially since he alone knew what Matron Beanri expected of his point group. And so they arrived in full, at the stairway, and up it they climbed to the very gates of Blingdenstone, gates that a drow engineer found devilishly trapped, with the entire ceiling above them rigged to fall if they were opened. Euthygentol called to a priestess that had been assigned to his group.
"You can get one of us past the barrier," his fingers asked her, to which she nodded.
Euthygentol's stream of surprises continued when he indicated he would personally enter the Svirfneblin city. It was an unheard-of request. No drow leader ever went in first. That's what commoners were for. But again, who would argue with Euthygentol? In truth, the priestess really didn't care if this arrogant male got torn apart. She began her casting at once, a spell that would make Euthygentol as insubstantial as a wraith, would make his form melt away into something that could slip through the slightest cracks. When it was done, the brave Euthygentol left without hesitation, without bothering to leave instructions in the event that he did not return. Proud and supremely confident, Euthygentol simply did not think that way. A few minutes later, after passing through the empty guard chambers, crisscrossed with cunningly built trenches and fortifications, Euthygentol became only the second drow, after Drizdo Erden, to glance at the rounded natural houses of the Svirfnebli and the winding, unremarkable ways that composed their city. How different Blingdenstone was from Menzo Baranzon, built in accord with what the gnomes had found in the natural caverns, rather than sculpted and reformed into an image that a dark elf would consider more pleasing. Euthygentol, who demanded control of everything around him, found the place repulsive. He also found it, this most ancient and hallowed of Svirfneblin cities, deserted. Belwar Disengulp stared out from the lip of the deep chamber, far to the west of Blingdenstone, and wondered if he had done right in convincing King Schnicktick to abandon the gnomish city. The most honored borough warden had reasoned that, with magic returned, the drow would surely march for Mithril Hall, and that course, Belwar knew, would take them dangerously close to Blingdenstone. Though he had little difficulty in convincing his fellows that the Dark Elves would march, the thought of leaving Blingdenstone, of simply packing up their belongings and deserting their ancient home, had not settled well. For more than 2,000 years the gnomes had lived in the ominous shadow of Menzo Baranzon, and more than once had they believed the drow would come in full war against them. This time was different, Belwar reasoned, and he had told them so. His speech full of passion and carrying the weight of his relationship with the renegade drow from that terrible city. Still, Belwar was far from convincing Schnicktick and the others until Councillor Furble piped in on the borough warden's side. It was indeed different this time, Furble had told them with all sincerity. This time, the whole of Menzo Baranzon would band together, and any attack would not be the ambitious probing of a single house. This time the gnomes, and anyone else unfortunate enough to fall in the path of the drow march, could not depend on inter-house rivalries to save them. Furble had learned of House Oblodra's fall from Jarlaxle. An earth elemental sent secretly under Menzo Baranzon and into the Claw Rift by Svirfneblin priests confirmed it, and the utter destruction of the third house. Thus when, at their last meeting, Jarlaxle hinted, it would not be wise to harbor Drizdo Erden. Furble, with his understanding of drow ways, reasoned that the Dark Elves would indeed march for Mithril Hall, in a force unified by the fear of the one who had so utterly crushed the third house. And so, on that ominous note, the Svirfnebli had left Blingdenstone, and Belwar had played a critical role in the departure. That responsibility weighed heavily on the Borough Warden now, made him second-guess the reasoning that had seemed so sound when he had thought danger imminent. Here to the west the tunnels were quiet, and not eerily so, as though enemy dark elves were slipping from shadow to shadow. The tunnels were quiet with peace. The war Belwar had anticipated seemed 1,000 miles or 1,000 years away. The other gnomes felt it too. And Belwar had overheard more than one complaining that the decision to leave Blingdenstone had been, at best, foolish. Only when the last of the Zwerfnebli had left the city, when the long caravan had begun its march to the west, had Belwar realized the gravity of the departure, realized the emotional burden. In leaving, the gnomes were admitting to themselves that they were no match for the drow, that they could not protect themselves or their homes from the dark elves. More than a few Zwerfnebli, Belwar perhaps most among them, were sick about that fact. Their illusions of security, of the strength of their shamans, of their very god figure had been shaken without a single drop of spilled Zwerfneblin blood. Belwar felt like a coward. The most honored Borough Warden took some comfort in the fact that eyes were still in place in Blingdenstone. A friendly elemental, blended with a stone, had been ordered to wait and watch, and to report back to the Zwerfneblin shamans who had summoned it. If the dark elves did come in, as Belwar expected, the gnomes would know of it. But what if they didn't come? Belwar wondered. If he and Firbol were wrong and the march did not come, then what loss had the Zwerfnebli suffered for the sake of caution? Could any of them ever feel secure in Blingdenstone again? Matron Beanri was not pleased at Yutha Gentall's report that the gnomish city was deserted. As sour as her expression was, though, it could not match the open wrath showing on the face of Bergignon at her side. His eyes narrowed dangerously as he considered the powerful patron of the second house, and Yutha Gentall, seeing a challenge, more than matched that ominous stare. Beanri understood the source of Bergignon's anger, and she too was not pleased by the fact that Yutha Gentall had taken it upon himself to enter Blingdenstone. That act reflected clearly the desperation of Mesbaris. Obviously, Mesbaris felt vulnerable in the shadows of Matron Beanri's display against Oblodra, and thus she had placed a great weight upon Yutha Gentall's broad shoulders. Yutha Gentall marched for the glory of Barriss and Dalarmgo, Matron Beanri knew, marched fanatically along with his force of more than 300 drow warriors. To Bergignon, that was not a good thing, for he, and not Matron Beanri, was in direct competition with the powerful weapons master. Matron Beanri considered all the news in light of her son's expression, and in the end, she thought Yutha Gentall's daring a good thing. The competition would push Bergignon to excellence, and if he failed, if Yutha Gentall was the one who killed Driz Doerden, for that was obviously the prize both sought, even if Bergignon was killed by Yutha Gentall, then so be it. This march was greater than House Beanri, greater than anyone's personal goals, except, of course, for Matron Beanri's own. When Mithril Hall was conquered, whatever the cost to her son, she would be in the highest glory of the Spider Queen, and her house would be above the schemes of the others, if all the others combined their forces against her.
"You are dismissed," Beanri said to Yutha Gentall. "Back to the forefront."
The spike-haired weapons master smiled wickedly and bowed, never taking his eyes from Bergignon. Then he spun on his heel to leave, but spun again immediately as Beanri addressed him once more.
"And if you chance to come upon the tracks of the fleeing Zwerfnebli," Beanri said,
and she paused, looking from Yutha Gentall to Bergignon.
"Do send an emissary to inform me of the chase."
Bergignon's shoulders slumped, even as Yutha Gentall's grin, showing those filed, pointy teeth, widened so much that it nearly took in his ears. He bowed again and ran off.
"The Zwerfnebli are mighty foes," Beanri said offhandedly, aiming the remark at Bergignon. "They will kill him and all of his party."
She didn't really believe the claim, had made it only for Bergignon's sake. In looking at her wise son, though, she realized he didn't believe it either.
"And if not," Banry said,
looking the other way to Quenthel, who stood by impassively, appearing quite bored, and to Methil, who always seemed quite bored,
"the gnomes are not so great a prize."
The matron mother's gaze snapped back over Bourguignon.
"We know the prize of this march," she said,
her voice a feral snarl. She didn't bother to mention that her ultimate goal and Bourguignon's goal were not the same.